The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Super Bowl Sunday on Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through till 10 p.m. on this Sunday night, the first day of February. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. First up, we'll welcome in Marky Ramon. And we'll discuss his new book, Punk Rock Blitzkrieg. Then entering the ring will be WWE legend, actor, author George the Animal Steele. Next, we'll hit the hardwood with former Knick and former NBA guard Rod Strickland. And we'll wrap things up with former member of the Moody Blues and the guitars for Paul McCartney's Wings. The great Denny Lane will join us. So we've got a full and legendary lineup on this Super Bowl Sunday. So I expect everyone will be turning off the game right now, or at least turning the sound off. Folks, it's only the Super Bowl. There'll be another one along in about a year or so. So sit back, relax, enjoy a very special edition of Sports Talk 1240 tonight on WGBB. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, cleverly titled Sports Talk 1240. You'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest is a native of Brooklyn, USA, and he joined the Ramones in 1978, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2002, along with Johnny, Joey, Dee Dee, and Tommy. He's received both a Grammy and an MTV Lifetime Achievement Award. His new book is titled Punk Rock Blitzkrieg, and he'll be signing that book this Tuesday night, February 3rd at 7 p.m. up at Book Review in Huntington. And we welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Marky Ramon. Marky, good evening.
Hello there. How are you?
Great. Great to have you aboard.
Thank you very much.
Now, you're from Erasmus.
Yeah.
And you're a self-taught drummer. Who are your influences?
Well, Ringo was from the Beatles, Charlie Watts from the Stones, Keith Moon from The Who. Mitch Mitchell from Jimi Hendrix Experience, Buddy Rich, Ginger Baker, Hal Blaine from the Wrecking Crew, Phil Spector's drummer, all the guys that I really loved growing up, you know?
Sure, okay. Now, you used to take the subway into the village, and the book says you used to hang out with Jimi Hendrix, Buddy Miles, Jim Morrison. Where'd you do that, and you got any good stories about those guys?
Well, I was 16, and I knew a guy who knew him. He was older than I was, and he was friends with Jimmy.
Yeah.
So one day he said, hey, come down to the Salvation, which was a club, and we went down there, and there he was, sitting at a round table with Jim Morrison and Buddy Miles. They were... Buddy and Jimmy were rehearsing for the New Year's Eve shows at the Fillmore East for the Band of Gypsies album. So I was just in awe. I couldn't speak. I couldn't do anything. 16-year-old kid, you know, these three rock stars there.
Sure.
And the next day, I go to school. I'm in the 10th grade, I think. Yeah, 10th or 11th grade. And I said to all my friends, I was with Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison. They didn't believe it.
Yeah, right.
You know, but, you know, back then there were no cell phones. You couldn't take any photos, you know.
So, yeah, they just had to believe you.
Yeah, well, I tried.
Yeah. You know? Now, you auditioned for the New York Dolls.
Yes.
And you went on to play for Wayne County and the Backstreet Boys.
Yes.
That's pretty good before joining the Ramones. Now,
yeah.
It's interesting. People may not know how the Ramones got the name, how that name came about.
Well, that came about from Paul McCartney when
right.
He was in the Silver Beatles. At that time, they weren't the Beatles yet, but they were making waves, and he didn't want to be constantly bothered in his hotel room, so he would just call himself Paul Ramone. And obviously, later on, he would change it back to Paul McCartney when the Beatles were the Beatles.
Right. And what followed from the Ramones was history.
Two and a half minute
songs with the hooks that sticks in your head forever, like I Want to Be Sedated.
Yep.
Blitzkrieg,
first song I recorded.
Exactly. Now, through 15 years, Marky's the guy who gave the beat to those songs. 9 studio albums, 1,700 shows with Joey, Johnny, and Dee Dee. We're speaking to Marky Ramone tonight. Tell us about the audition process that you had for the Ramones, Marky.
Well, they all used to come see me when I had my own bands before there was the Ramones. I did 5 albums before I joined them, and they would come see my group, Dust. And we were one of the first heavy metal bands in America in the early 70s. So they would be in the audience, and then later on when Tommy left only after 3 years because he wanted to produce, he suggested to the others to, get me in the group. So we had a small audition. I knew I was in already anyway, but we did 3 songs, and that was it. And then they gave me a tape of the album, which would be the first one I would record with, and their live show, which was 40 songs that I had to learn in 2 weeks.
Ooh.
Yeah, they had commitments, so we had to, get down to working real hard, and I just had my drum pads, my sticks, my boombox, headphones, and I managed to learn 40 songs in 2 weeks.
Good. Okay. Now, do you remember the first gig you had with the band?
Oh, yeah. It wasn't stressful or anxiety-ridden. It was just something that I knew that I could do. You got to think positive. You got to do it. Any of that negative stress stuff will take your mind off it. So I did what I learned, and at the end, everything worked out. We were all happy that it worked out.
Do you remember where it was?
It was in Poughkeepsie.
Poughkeepsie?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Of all places. Beautiful,
Yeah. Beautiful
Poughkeepsie.
Right, and then from there, the world.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, nice place to start.
Yep.
If any place, why not Poughkeepsie?
Right, definitely.
Exactly, yeah, okay. Now, let's talk about some of the guys in the band. You had Joey. Everybody knows Joey, the lead singer, introverted, the songwriter. Now, he had OCD, didn't he, Joey?
Yeah, he did. And we didn't know what it was then until much later. And Johnny and Dee Dee thought he was just trying to irritate them, but he wasn't. He was just inflicted by that, and he would have to touch a curb, go back, touch the curb, go back,
Yeah.
Repetitions. So we didn't know what it was. And then later on, there was some kind of pills he was taking to alleviate that situation, which it did. But then he stopped taking them, and then it came back again, But, as time went on, we all understood it. Back then, we had no idea.
Exactly, yeah. Not easy to deal with. Yeah, I know that for a fact. Now, and then there's Johnny. Tough to deal with again, I guess. Johnny is right-wing politics, very straight-laced guy. Talk a little bit about Johnny.
Well, he was very political about the conservative issues, and Joey was a left-wing liberal Democrat, so a lot of the times in the van, which I toured with them for 15 years in, our trusty 15-passenger Ford Econoline, that's where the animosities would come in about the fighting about politics. So, sometimes they say opposites attract, but in this case, it just helped with the animosities of the two,
Yeah. Well, yeah, friction right there. And then you had Dee Dee, who was kind of the eccentric of the group.
Yeah, he was the main songwriter. He had a very childlike, vivid imagination, and that's why he was such a great songwriter, because he integrated the two, But he had a drug problem, and, I had a drinking problem a little later on. But, I worked my problem out, and he just continued. And unfortunately, he died of an overdose later on, in, I think, 2000 and 2003 or 2004.
Yeah. Yeah, that he did. Now, we're speaking to Marky Ramone tonight. Describe for us, if you can, I was never there, the CBGB scene, Marky.
Yeah.
Just what that place was like.
Right. It was our home. It was just a hole in the wall, but we were there to hone our skills. It was basically the bands get tighter. It was Blondie, Ramones, Talking mm-hmm. Heads, Television, Patti Smith, a guy named Richard Hell. And so we all had a place to play. And every time we would go back, we would get tighter and tighter and tighter. So I mentioned that in the book, you know, that. You know, there weren't that many places to play back then because a lot of clubs didn't want to book our genre music. They were into disco. They were into, you know, stadium rock. They were into, like, the hits, you know, hits of the 60s.
Yeah.
Bands that were still together that were playing their hits from the 60s. So, you know, we were up against a lot at that moment, you know.
No punk clubs, no new wave clubs, no place.
No, not
yet.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
That's why no place for Blondie, Talking Heads, Ramones.
Not yet.
Yeah,
no
place for you guys to go.
Yeah.
In the book, you also talk about meeting Stephen King. Stephen King was a big fan.
Great guy. He mentioned us in a few of his books, and he wanted us to do the song to the soundtrack and movie, Pet Sematary. So we were eating dinner with him at his house in Maine, and the next thing you know, he comes down with the book. Gives it to Didi Ramone, our bass player. He skims through it and writes the song in 40 minutes, Pet Sematary.
Amazing.
Definitely. That's what got us out of our doldrums for 4 years. You know, that was the song that kind of brought us back, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great story, yeah. Now, another huge fan of the Ramones was Bono.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Another good guy. He loved us. His band used to do Ramon songs to start, you know, to rehearse, to get to where they were. And then eventually, obviously, they did their own originals, but they cited us as an influence in the beginning, along with Pearl Jam and Joan Jett and, Green Day, Offspring, all these groups. So we were always grateful for that, you know.
Not too shabby.
Nope.
Not at all.
Pretty good lineup there.
Yeah. We're speaking to Marky Ramone tonight. His new book, Punk Rock Blitzkrieg, he'll be signing that up at Book Review in Huntington this week. And as you say, Marky, we all have problems. You had the drinking problem. You drove through a storefront window, which is not too bad.
Pretty bad.
You took out a storefront window. They forced you out.
I went into the store.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I mean,
but you became a bike messenger.
Yeah, after that I realized, look, this has to stop. You know?
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
I was drinking a lot of beer, and I was a periodic. So hot day, I had a six-pack of Newcastle Brown, and I was drinking some martinis, and I got back in the car, I blacked out, and my foot, instead of going on the brake, stepped on the accelerator and went right through the window. Luckily, I didn't kill anybody or myself, and that's what got me thinking, what am I doing, you know?
Yeah, right.
This isn't cool. This isn't good. It's not funny. So I had to go away for a while and learn that what's more important, doing that, you know, nonsense or following your dreams in life. So I managed to pick myself up, get on the right track, and do what I had to do to, stop the nonsense. So I've been straight for 31 years already.
31 years you've been doing
nothing.
The right thing. Yeah.
And I never smoked cigarettes, believe it or not.
And that's pretty amazing for a rock and roll guy not to be smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, I mean,
When you look at somebody like Keith Richards, who every time you look at the guy has got a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. Yeah.
I mean, in any business, you know. You know, it could happen to anybody. It doesn't matter what business you're in, you know. It's just that it can become an addiction, you know.
Definitely. Now, how did you guys view the UK the punk counterparts like the Sex Pistols, the Clash? Did you form like a camaraderie between those guys, or was it more of a competition?
Oh, I toured with the Clash for Richard Hell and the Voidoids for 4.5 weeks in England in 1977. We loved each other. We were like brothers. We had a great time. They wanted an American. A real American punk rock band to tour with them, which we did, and that was the beginning of their of their era there, because they were about a year behind us. And they had great songs. The first Sex Pistols album was great, but they petered out after only 2 years, you know. But the Clash went on, and I think to 1983, and they stopped. But we were together for 22 years.
Right.
So, you know, their thing was very political. You know, our thing was just to have a good time, have fun, you know, stop thinking of the worries and just enjoy yourself for that moment. You know what I mean?
Definitely. They were, yeah, the Sex Pistols, the Clash, very into the political
very
thing.
Very political, yeah.
In fact, Mr. Lydon's coming out with a book. It's out in the UK. I think he's bringing it stateside in April.
Okay.
So we'll have to look forward to that,
yeah,
to read his story.
Yeah, my book's number one on Amazon on punk rock autobiographies. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's doing. All my friends are reading it. Yeah, it's getting great reviews.
Yeah, 3 weeks,
Marky.
Already.
Yeah. Oh, it's just tremendous.
Who knew? You know what I
exactly.
mean? I just wrote a book.
Yeah.
It took me 5 years. I was in the band for 15 years, and other things I did in life. My, you know, working with Phil Spector, making Rock and Roll High School, going to the Hall of Fame and the Grammys, all that's in the book, you know, everything, the New York, what was happening in New York in the 70s, where I went to school, yeah, all that stuff, you know, so
it's a great read, definitely. Now, you guys are viewed as legendary icons. You ever get a picture of that, you guys, when you were together, that you were viewed that way, that you would be looked upon as pioneers in the punk scene?
Well, we were pioneers, but we weren't into that rock star stuff, you know, icons or, you know, rock star stuff and all that. We always treated our fans and friends like they were one of us, you know. Maybe that's why they liked us, you know. They saw that, you know, genuine kind of emotion, you know?
Definitely, yeah. Now talk about Rock and Roll High School. That's a classic rock
yeah.
and roll film. It's a cult favorite. Talk about making that film a little bit, Marky.
Well, we toured our way from the East to the West Coast. And then we get to Hollywood, and you know, you sit around all day waiting for your part. It could only be a 10-minute part, but you're there from 7 o'clock to 5:30 at night, so you got to get up at about, you know, 5:36. You know, they make you up, whatever they do, but you know, you're sitting there going when. So the movie took 6 weeks to make, and it was a lot of fun to see what it's like to make a movie. So we have a concert scene in there. We have some acting parts. We all have one line each or two lines each. So I was a little disappointed I didn't win the Academy Award.
Yeah, right. What was your line? Do you remember?
My one line was to the music teacher. He made a joke. No one laughed. So I gave him a little tap on the arm, and I said, gee, that was a good one, Mr. McGree. You know, then the class started laughing. So, you know, you got to see the movie to really see what's going on in it, you know.
To fully appreciate the Marky Ramone shtick. Yeah,
right, like being on The Simpsons.
Yeah.
When I was on The Simpsons, so I had one line. My one line was, gee, I think they liked us.
Yeah.
That was it.
Well, you know you've made it when you're on The Simpsons, Marky.
Exactly.
That's, yeah.
When you're a cartoon on The Simpsons,
yeah.
You arrive.
I mean, the Rolling Stones, Paul McCartney, The Who, they're all in The Simpsons.
Yeah, that's a great show.
Definitely. So you have so many catchy songs with the great hooks, Marky.
Yeah.
How come the band has never had a hit? What do you think the issue is there?
Well, in the last 15 years, they've all become hits. It's just that in the beginning, because a lot of DJs didn't want to play us back then, and you don't get radio play, you're not going to get a hit. So I think because of that reasoning, eventually a lot of the DJs became fans. As they got older, you know, when they got more established, they started playing us a lot more. And that's why you'll hear Blitzkrieg Bop at baseball games, football games, and, you know, I Want to Be Sedated on all the classic rock stations. Sheena is a punk rocker, Rockaway Beach. So, you know, better late than never, you know.
Exactly. It's become more mainstream and classic in their own sense.
And we really are an all-American band. It's the all-American band.
Exactly. We're speaking to Marky Ramone tonight on Sports Talk 1240. The Ramones, not really hot-wired in the punk garage rock, but other flavors went into the mixture, like the 60s British Invasion.
Oh, yeah.
Brill building
Phil Spector
pop,
stuff. Yeah.
Right, the Phil Spector. Give us more insight into that.
Well, we liked the British, the Kinks. We liked the Who. We liked, obviously, the Beatles. We liked the Ronettes. We liked Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, Elvis. We liked... you know, a lot of that stuff you bring, you know, and the doo-wop bands, you throw that up in the air. It comes down as a Ramones omelet, you know.
That's a good way of putting it, exactly.
Yeah, so that's what we were, really, just a fast rock band with good tunes with a bunch of amplification behind us.
Does the band, do you ever feel bad that people like Green Day are more commercially viable now, or the Clash? Than the Ramones are, because the...
Well, Green Day is. I don't know about the Clash.
Yeah.
But they cited us as an influence, and obviously they use it within their songs. And we were very cool with that. We let them play at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for us because Joey passed away, and we didn't have a singer, so they were able to play there for us. We were very grateful for that because we couldn't play. We weren't going to play without Joey, you know. So,
cool.
You know, we were always grateful when we heard our sound integrated with another band's sound, you know.
What do you miss most about your days with the Ramones, Marky?
Oh, I miss Johnny, Joey, Dee Dee, and Tommy.
You miss the boys.
Of course.
Yeah.
They were my brothers, bandmates. Friends, brothers fight, they make up, you know, bandmates, you know, we had a job to do, and we did it, you know.
Definitely. Now, looking back, do you have any memorable moments on the stage, funny, scary?
Yeah, I do.
Go ahead.
Oh, boy. Me, you know, I'm not into the raw fish thing, the sushi stuff. You know, I know it's good and whatever, but I'm not into it anyway. Me and Joey went to eat at a Japanese restaurant, and the sushi, I guess, was rotten. But, you know, you can cover it up, you know what I mean? So the next thing I know, you know, before we go on stage, I start burping. You know, like, it's the salsa water, you know? So I go on the stage, we're playing. Next thing I know, I throw up all over my snare drum while I'm playing. So the roadie come, and I'm wearing my sunglasses because of the lights.
Right.
And Joey wore sunglasses, too, because we wore prescription sunglasses. So the throw-ups on my sunglasses, my face, my roadie's trying to clean off the snare drum. I'm hitting his hands with the stick because I can't lose the beat. And, you know, it's like this stuff, you can't make this stuff up.
No.
Next thing you know, the song stops. He wipes my face, the snare drum, but he forgets to wipe my glasses.
Right.
So it's like, here I am, and I can't even see anything, you know. So that was funny at the moment, you know.
That's,
I mean,
a good
at
one.
The moment, but
yeah.
Now it's funny, you know.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a classic. Marky Ramone on Sports Talk 1240 tonight. Well, I'm happy to report that Ramone fanaticism remains as high as ever, because the Joey Ramone street sign at the corner of Bowery and what is it, West Second Street?
Second Street, yeah.
That's the most stolen in Manhattan.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
So that's good news.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
So it, do you have one of those, Marky?
Not yet.
No,
I'm still alive.
You should work on, getting one of those.
That's okay. No. I don't care. Yeah.
Now you're still performing. You performed at Barclays?
Yeah, I tour all over the world. I have Andy WLK as my singer, and we continue to do these songs because they're too good not to be played.
Right.
And I do 36 Ramone songs with him, and we just did a show, sold-out show in New York. So So and I appear as a guest with other bands because they want to play the Ramones songs too. So
right, you appeared recently at Barclays with Fall Out Boy and Arcade Fire.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. They just called me up. I went there and we rehearsed in the dressing room, and we did two songs. Each band did. I played two songs with each band, and it was great. The crowd loved it, you know.
Sure, why not?
Yeah, so it's things like that keep the legacy alive and perpetuates the name. So.
And it's not bad receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Grammys.
No, I never expected that. I was driving my car, I get the phone call, and you know where the cops sometimes they park, they have a little area there where they can hang out and chill for a minute or whatever.
Yeah.
I parked where the cops usually parked. I was talking to the guy. I couldn't believe it. I go, is this for real?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the guy goes, yes, it is. You have to come so-and-so here at this. And I'm the first one they called.
Yeah.
I go, don't you have the connection to the managerial company? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And obviously they didn't, the management didn't have it together. So they had to come through me, and then I had to tell the managers and everyone else. So we all went down, and me, Johnny, Joey, Dee Dee, and Tommy got the Lifetime Achievement Grammy Award. But Johnny and Joey and Dee Dee weren't able to come. It was just me and Tommy.
That's nice.
So that was sad, you know. I mean,
yeah.
But at least somebody was there to represent the group, you know.
Definitely. Beautiful thing. Now, you're on Sirius Radio as well.
Oh,
Marky.
Yeah. Channel 41, Faction, it's called, 8 o'clock at night, Wednesday and Saturday, California time.
And you have your own pasta sauce.
Yeah. My grandfather was a chef at the Copacabana in New York City for 20 years, and then the 21 for 10 years. Then he retired. I used to go to his house and my parents and watch him cook. I couldn't believe it. How he used to handle the knives, and I'd not cut his fingers off, you know, cutting the celery, the onions, the garlic, the this, the that. So when I got, when I left my house at 18, I cooked my own spaghetti, and it kept me going for a few days, you know. I'd eat it cold.
Sure.
But later on, I was approached by someone to make my own sauce. Obviously, the ingredients are a little better than what I had back then, but it took 6 months to make. Some of it was too watery, some of it too plumpy, some of it was too sweet, salty. So I had to back away from it for a while, you know. Then I came back to it, and I did the same thing. Eventually, I got it right because of the tomatoes. I used plum tomatoes, not regular tomatoes.
Aha, okay.
Yeah, that's what made the consistency good, and I'm proud to say that part of the proceeds goes to Autism Speaks.
That's great. Now, where can people get all this stuff?
So you go to MarkyRamone.com and all the info's on there.
Beautiful. Okay. Well, Marky, it's been great talking about your career, about the glory days of the
thanks
Ramones.
Thanks for having me.
We thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night, tearing you away from the Super Bowl.
Don't worry about it.
To talk with us. The book, again, is called Punk Rock Blitzkrieg. Outstanding book. It's a wonderful read. You'll go through it really fast. Some beautiful stories about the Ramones in there.
Oh, boy.
Marky, again, will be at Book Review up in Huntington Village this Tuesday the 3rd at 7 o'clock. Get up there. Marky will sign your book. And he'll be the 4th at Barnes & Noble in Staten Island.
Yep.
The legendary Marky Ramone, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks, everyone.
Take care.
Bye.
Next up, we enter the ring with one of the legends of the squared circle, George the Animal Steel. Stay with us, folks.
Sports Radio New York and AM 1240 WDBB are proud to announce the new Sports Talk 1240, along with the launch of a brand new website at sportstalk1240.com. Check out our new site for information about upcoming shows, as well as easy access to past shows, articles, our live studio webcam, and more. Of course, be sure to tune in to Sports Talk 1240 every Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. on AM 1240 WGBB or visit sportstalk1240.com for ways to listen to the live broadcast online or from your iPhone. We're excited about these new changes and hope you will be too.
So you're looking for a great club but don't want to go into Manhattan. Or you'd like to find a new restaurant to check out. Or you're buying a house here on Long Island and you'd like to find out about a certain area. Wouldn't it be nice if you can find out all the information in just one spot? Well, you can. LongIslandExchange.com. It's all you need to find out all about Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com for hotspots, classifieds, news, and more. LongIslandExchange.com is designed with only the Long Islander in mind. Get the best of Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com. Discover Long Island all over again at LongIslandExchange.com.
If you're trying to quit smoking, dipping, or chewing tobacco, you don't have to do it alone. Nicotine Anonymous is a 12-step program of recovery that meets regularly in your area. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be free of nicotine. For information and meetings near you, call 877-TRY-NIC-A. That's 877-TRY-NICA. Or visit nicotine-anonymous.org. Let us share our experience, strength, and hope with you.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240. Check us out every Sunday night at 8 p.m. right here on AM 1240 WGBB. And visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Making simple changes in your everyday travel choices makes a big difference to New York's air quality. Trip change. Use mass transit, rideshare, bike, or walk. Visit cleanairny.org to learn more. Clean Air New York. Breathe it in. A public service message brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation.
And now, back to Sports Talk 1240.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Phil Donahue with you on this Super Bowl Sunday night. Hope you're enjoying this special edition of Sports Talk 1240 tonight. The game gets boring, which I don't think it is. I think it's 14-14 at the half. Turn the sound down anyway. Turn this up. My next guest, he's a former professional wrestler, also an actor as well as an author. His career lasted from 1967 through 1988, though he did make some appearances in the 1990s as well as the 2000s. He made a memorable appearance as well, portraying Swedish wrestler and actor Tor Johnson in Ed Wood. Remember that very well. Directed by Tim Burton, starring Johnny Depp. He was elected to the WWE Hall of Fame in 1995. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, George the Animal Steel. George, good evening.
Hey, how you doing?
Great to have you aboard with us.
Let me tell you something. Wow, we do have a football game.
Yeah, not bad, huh?
Great.
Well, what would you rather me call you, Jim or George?
Well, if you call me for dinner, I don't care which.
Yeah. All right. All right. Well, George, who were your favorite athletes growing up? Who did you root for?
Oh, boy. You know, I go way back to Bobby Lane in Detroit.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You're a Michigan guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you used to work.
I don't go as far back as Ty Cobb, but I guess I probably could.
No, you don't. You're not that far. Now, as a high school athlete, you were a high school athlete. You went to Michigan State. You played football for the Spartans.
Go Green.
Yeah. And you had to stop, though, right? You had a knee injury?
Oh, I had. You know what? Basically, I had a learning disability.
Okay.
I had dyslexic before they knew what it was. Very dyslexic. I was over the top. But in high school, they would take rolls and send me to the gym. So, you know, if you spend all your time in the gym, you should become a pretty good athlete.
Okay.
And while I was at Michigan State, they figured out what was wrong with me and turned my life around, really, because I was really kind of screwed up with it. You know, no one knew what the teachers didn't know what it was.
Yeah, right.
So it was a problem. But, I look back in hindsight, that God was in control all the way.
I see. Yeah, I understand. Sure. Now, you got your degrees. You did get your bachelor's. You got your master's. You started teaching. Now, to supplement your income, you turned to professional wrestling.
That's exactly right.
Now,
here's the part that a lot of people miss.
Go ahead.
I kept professional wrestling as a part-time summer job until 1985.
Okay.
All that New York, Boston, Philadelphia, all that WWF and WWF was all on a part-time basis. But I was only available in the summertime, so, they pushed me pretty good. I did real well. And looking back, I was able to continue to teach and coach, which I really love to do. And it all just worked out really. It's unbelievable how it worked out, to be honest with you.
It worked out great.
Yeah.
Now, you were scouted by probably the greatest wrestler ever, Bruno Sammartino.
No, probably to it. The greatest champion of all time. Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, we're speaking with George the Animal Steele tonight. How did you get the name George Steele?
Well, when I started wrestling, my name is Jim Myers.
Right.
And when I started wrestling, it was just around the Michigan area, and I wore a mask, and they called me the student because I was learning a new business.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I left the Detroit area, I was invited to Pittsburgh. Bruno had come to the Cobo Arena in Detroit and spotted me, and I was invited by his entourage to come back to Pittsburgh and challenge Bruno. So when I got there, I had my mask, and I was a student. And they said, no, we don't want that. We don't want a mask, man. We want you. I said, well, I can't use my real name because of the teaching and coaching.
Right.
Johnny DeFazio, one of the locals there in Pittsburgh, said, well, this is a steel city. Why not Jim Steele? I said, I like steel. Somebody else said George, and that part of my body is only about 42 years old now.
Okay, good. Yeah, so that's how it developed. Now,
at one
point you told one of the WWF commentators that you were the nephew of Ray Steele, that developed another storyline. Tell us about Ray Steele and how that developed.
Well, Ray Steele was a WWF world champion. Now, you know, I'm not even sure it was a WWF. It would have been before that because it didn't start until 1961 or something like that. So Ray Steele was way before that.
Okay.
But he was an honored champion in the gardens in the Northeast and actually the world. And his name was Steele. So one of the guys said, "Well, is he your uncle?" I said, "He must be." And from that
sure,
time on,
yeah, why
is my uncle?
Why not? Yeah. Okay. Now, Jim. You used a series of arm locks. Now, the weaken your opponents, that was your signature move, the flying hammer lock. Describe that for the folks.
Well, it's funny. A hammer lock, you put a hammer lock, you know, it's behind them. And lift it. I could lift a guy up and hold him, which is really hard to do, and had pretty good balance. And then we dislocated a couple of shoulders doing it, but it was devastating as far as the look was concerned. Naturally, we tried to protect our opponents so it didn't hurt everybody, but it was a pretty devastating-looking thing. And I coached high school wrestling for 17 years. A lot of people didn't realize that, so I did know how to use wrestling hold. I did eat a lot of turnbuckles and other stuff, but I did know how to wrestle. It says wrestling on the marquee, but I didn't do what they said on the marquee.
Right.
I was a showman.
Right. So there was a period, too, during one match. You wrestled Bruno Sammartino to an hour-long draw at Madison Square Garden.
Yes.
Tell us about that particular match. That's a pretty famous match.
Well, that was probably the toughest thing I ever went through. It was a curfew match, and with about 15 minutes left to go, I was completely beaten. I was wore out. I was tired. It's just like, so I started acting like it was a basketball game, and I would roll out of the ring and get a 10 count. In fact, it was a 20 count, so I was stalling, and I'd roll back in and roll back out, and then with about 4 minutes left to go, I pretty well recovered, and I put a big attack on Bruno and almost beat him. So you know how it used to be when they could stall with the basketball before they had the
yeah.
Shot clock?
Yeah, right.
I had people going nuts. You big chicken.
Yeah.
And then when I went back in and had started fighting again, we almost had a riot. It was pretty phenomenal.
And then,
we were going to have a return match. Hopefully it would be in a cage. And it was turned down by the athletic commission. So Vince McMahon Sr., not the guy running the show now, but his dad.
His father.
What are we going to do? We could have a cage match. We're going to put on. I said, let's have a money cage. So we announced that if Bruno or I, either one, went on the following, the return match. If we went on the apron, it was $1,000 fine. If we went on the floor, it was a $5,000 fine. And so, working the match, I'd go out and start to go through the ropes. I guess going out, and I don't want to spend the money. And we had a cage match without a cage, just the money thing. And the people were counting. When I went on the floor, they start counting how much money I was losing. And it was really, really kind of a funny thing, but it got over big time.
So you had a rematch against them, but you lost the rematch.
Always, yes.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Now, I had a question from a listener, a friend of mine. He wanted to know, besides Bruno Sammartino, who was your toughest opponent?
You know what? I was blessed with wrestling a lot of the very top people in the business. Early on in my career, there was a guy by the name of Killer Kowalski, Walter Kowalski.
Mm-hmm.
And we turned on each other, and we had a battle that was phenomenal. Then there was I had a few matches with Bobby Backlund, who was not a Bruno Sammartino, but it was a totally different style.
Right.
And that was something. Later on in my career, actually at a point when I was probably a dinosaur in wrestling, I had a great run with Randy Savage.
The Macho Man.
And Mrs. Elizabeth.
Right. We'll talk
nice.
About them. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You got it.
Yeah, he was a good one. God rest his soul, yeah. We're speaking to Jim Myers, George the Animal Steel, tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, in Boston, you were being set up to face Sammartino for a long series. He got one of the few clean wins over Victor Rivera. Remember Victor Rivera?
I sure do.
With a flying hammerlock submission. It was a huge Fenway Park outdoor show. Do you remember that one, George?
I sure do, yeah. And it was Bruno, I think, wrestled Kowalski on that show, and I wrestled Victor Rivera, who was at that time one of the very top Spanish people in the business.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrestled him in the Gardens also that same year. You know, honestly, I was lucky to have a competition like that. He was a good guy, and he was a great performer.
And then I believe you were set up to have a feud with Chief J. Strongbow.
There's another one.
Yeah.
Another just a great talent, and, you know, I was blessed, I'm telling you, to wrestle what I think is the very best in the business.
Those were classic names, though, and Edward Carpentier.
Oh, yeah, Carpentier. Even one guy that was very different but good at his time was Haystack Calhoun.
Haystack Calhoun, definitely, yeah.
And Bruno picked him up, and he was like 500 pounds. Bruno picked him up and slammed him in the Gardens.
Mm.
I think the whole city of New York shut up that one.
Well, now you further reinvented the character of George the Animal Steel. You fully established that. You were a bad guy then.
I was the worst of the worst. I was a nasty, rotten, brawling heel that everybody hated.
Right.
And then later on, I became I call it a cartoon character.
Right.
But it was a lovable cartoon character that everybody loved. Go figure. And I was ugly both ways.
But you started tearing up the turnbuckles at about that time.
I started that a little earlier, honestly. It was black and white TV the first time I did that.
Yeah.
They used to give away, this happened in Pittsburgh when I first went there, they used to give away gifts for the studio wrestling, trying to get people to come to the studio. And they'd give away gifts. And this one particular show, they gave away satin pillows, like in the 50s and 60s, those real hard little pillows, you sit in the corner.
Yeah.
And they give away about 300 of them. One lady got mad and threw her pillow at me. So now I don't know, am I going to have a boring match and sit on it? Should I throw it back and have 300 pillows thrown at me?
Yeah.
I didn't know what to do with it, so I took a bite out of it, and it exploded because it was packed so tight. And I started throwing it in the air, and it was coming down. It was amazing how much stuffing was in this little pillow. And it was sticking in my hair like the Abominable Snowman. And then I took a pillow and put it over my opponent's head and started choking him. And, you know, with the pillow over his head, great TV. When I pulled it off, he was blue because the stuffing was lighter than air. And every time he'd take a breath, it was going down his lungs. They almost killed him.
Oh, gosh.
So I go to the dressing room, and they're all laughing. You almost killed that guy. And one guy said, yeah, boy, if you could get a pillow every night, that would really be something. You'd be special. And Tony Puglisi, Bruno's wrestling cousin, said, maybe you could eat a turnbuckle, tear the turnbuckles. And everybody laughed. About 2 weeks later, I was wrestling Strongbow. And the match was just kind of flat, which was kind of hard to do with Strongbow because he was so good. I looked at the turnbuckle. I thought, I wonder. And I went over and took a bite out of it. It tore easily. I rubbed it in his face, ran his hand in where the turnbuckle pad was protecting it from the steel circle that holds the ropes up, and I started a riot. From a flat match, it went right to what heat? So from then on, I figured, you know, I don't have to wrestle. I can just eat turnbuckles.
There you have it.
That's how things happened with me. Everything was just by accident, and taking advantage of it.
The story of how George Steele started eating turnbuckles, folks. There you have it. Amazing. Now, that's the story of that. Now, I looked it up, but let's hear your side of the story, George, on the green tongue.
The green tongue. I'd had a couple drinks. I didn't want the promoters to know it. Color TV has just come out now.
Okay.
And I put a couple of Clorets in my mouth, the old capsules.
Yeah.
And I put them in just for the breath. I go in the ring. It's live TV. And I always had a habit of sticking my tongue out, like kind of like Michael Jordan.
Right.
The tongue was green. I didn't even know it. So the switchboard lit up. They went nuts. And about 2 months later, for my own laughs, I said, I'm going to do the green tongue thing again. And I put the Clorets in. It happened again. From then on, I had the very best breath in all of wrestling.
From Clorets.
Yeah. All by accident. Who would have thought? And the first time it happened, they had, after the TV show the following Friday, they had big signs of big green tongues hanging all over the arena. Like, I kind of thought that was kind of strange, too.
That's amazing.
But it worked out. What can I tell you?
Yeah. So two of your signatures happened by accident.
Accident. Everything happened by accident with me.
Amazing. Yeah, that's a great story, George. Now, the stoop posture, the hairless head, and the thick mat of fur on your back, the wrestling broadcasters often referred to you, the animal was the missing link.
Yeah, you know how that started, the animal? This is funny, too. The WWF, you know, now they come up with names for guys and so on.
Right.
When I first went into New York and Boston, they used to call me the Destroyer, Georgia Destroyer, the Detroit Destroyer. And I didn't like that to begin with. And the fans, because of the hairy body and the look I had and the way I did things, pretty vicious, they'd start calling me an animal. And I would go on the microphone and scream at, I'm not an animal, I'm a people. And the more I did that, the more they called me the animal. And finally, the production company, you know, part of the WWF, said, heck, let's call him the animal. So the people really named me that, which is another unique thing.
And that stuck.
Oh, it's to this day. I have people come, are you the animal?
Amazing. Yeah, that's another amazing story.
And then you remember, when I first went to the Northeast in the first 10 years I wrestled, I did most all my own interviews. And I was pretty articulate with it.
This is an amazing, I read this too, folks. This is an amazing story. Go ahead, George. Yeah.
Vince tells me, he says, I'm doing an interview, and the boss of the company now, is doing the interviews for his dad, and I do my articulate interview, and he says, no. He says, that doesn't sound like an animal. Do an animal. I didn't like that because I liked doing interviews. So he put the mic in front of him. He said, that's what I want. I went, oh, cripe.
Yeah.
But it worked. What can I tell you?
Exactly. Vince McMahon did not want George to be articulate in his interviews. He preferred the garbled, incoherent syllables coming out of George the Animal Steele's mouth. Imagine that. That's what Vince McMahon, the genius that runs the WWF, that's what he preferred. So,
exactly.
Again, that's what sells. Amazing.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable where they've taken the business. It really is.
Yeah, and from that, the character of George the Animal Steele became one of the more popular and recognizable wrestlers during that 1980s professional wrestling boom.
My cartoon era.
Exactly.
And we were watching the Super Bowl just now at halftime and having a spectacular show. I said to my wife, I said, look there, Pat, their show is now, their fireworks and things are almost as good as the WWF was 20 years ago.
When you think about it, that was really the heyday. I remember that, George, with Hulkamania, and Rowdy Roddy Piper and
absolutely
and the Macho Man and Miss Elizabeth and all that. And then that was really the heyday of the WWF.
I think of the wrestling business, really.
Yeah,
that's when it started to really change. I liked it better before the change, to be honest with you. But for the way it is now, it's just unbelievably popular. It's a multi-billion-dollar business. What can I say? That's with a B, and it's well received.
Well, if it wasn't for Hulk Hogan, they wouldn't be where they are today.
Well, you know what? Vince had a vision, and Hulk Hogan just happened to fill that vision.
Yeah.
And so it was two guys getting together at the right time. At first, no knock on Hulk. He was the most charismatic wrestler I ever seen. Bruno was the best champion. I think that the Hulk was the most charismatic. And in our wrestling business, charismatic probably is the most important part of it.
Definitely. Now, your most famous feud, George, had to be against the Macho Man that we spoke about earlier. And,
it was more famous because TV was big. It was worldwide.
Definitely, everybody remembers George the Animal Steel against Macho Man Randy Savage, and George the Animal Steel developed a crush on Miss Elizabeth.
Boy, that was an easy job.
Yeah. Unfortunately, these two great people are no longer with us anymore. But what a made-for-TV situation that was, wasn't it?
Well, it was, they kind of had a story about Beauty and the Beast.
That's what it was, exactly.
And that's exactly what we were. Beauty and the Beast, and I tried to be sweet, and Macho Man, it was his wife, Elizabeth was his wife, and he was real mean to her on TV anyhow, and it really got over.
It really did. And the people, the fans really, really went for it.
Yes, they did.
It was amazing, and it played out for much longer, I think, than anybody thought it would.
I think when they did that switch with me in Saturday that main event, they thought that would last maybe three shows. It lasted 2 years.
Yeah,
and I really think they were. I think they were ready to. You know, I was 49, 50 years old. It was the end of my career. They were ready to move on, and I got another 2 years out of it, and really my retirement money came out of that. So it really, for me, it was a blessing. I think for Randy it was a blessing, for it put him on a pedestal that led later on to the championship and so on. Unfortunately, him and Liz had their run, their problems. And
right.
That ended up in just a tragedy, but that's the way, I guess, life goes.
Yeah, it really was a shame, George. But you also had got your stuffed animal, and that let you go for a while longer. Right?
That was too much.
Yeah.
There's a story behind that, too.
Okay, let's hear it.
What happened is I was down south in Hillbilly Jim.
Hillbilly Jim, right.
I was with my wife, and he says, "You got to see my traveling partner." So I didn't know. I thought it was another guy. I didn't know what it was. So we go into his room, and he's got laying on his bed a flat Earl the Dead Cat on stuffed animal. If you can picture this, it's a cat with his eyes crossed. It's flat. They never had any stuffings on it, and the tail was crooked. I said, I got to use it. So I'm doing some interviews that night, and Mean Gene Oakland is interviewing me, and I'm always joshing with him. I got this cat behind me. He's at, what are you going to do tonight? Earl. And towards the end, because they don't say many words anyhow now, I pull out Earl the Dead Cat. And I'm talking about my opponent's going to be like Earl the Dead Cat. And it was cute. Vince calls me in the next day. He says, "What are you doing?" I says, "What do you mean?" He said, "I saw you with that unstuffed animal, Earl." He says, "Why are we selling somebody else's product?" This is a genius of Vince. He said, "Why don't you develop your own thing and we'll sell it?" He says, "Anything you want, you develop it and we'll do it." So I come up with mine, because when kids fight over a toy, what do they say?
Mine.
Mine.
Yeah. Oh.
And we sold a truck full of them, and that was just before I got sick with Crohn's and my career came to an end. But that was huge, too. I mean, that was unbelievable.
Another ride for you.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And what would happen is I was too old to take bumps, so I'd take the mind out of the ring, and I had Velcro on his hands, so I could put it on the ropes and just swing around when you hit the ropes. And my opponents would get mad at me, and they couldn't do anything with me, so they'd take the mind dial and kick it and stomp it. Every time they did that, it acted like it was me. Then I would whack them a couple times and pick them up in the hammer lock, get the win, then have the referee lift the mind dial's hands, and the people bought into it. It was another phenomenal, fun thing that the fans, you know, wrestling fans are so loyal.
Yeah, they really are. They are the most rabid fans I've ever seen.
They are.
Amazing. Now let's talk a little bit about Ed Wood.
Okay.
Tell us about the filming of Ed Wood. Go ahead.
I get a phone call from Tim Burton. He tells me that he's going to be doing this movie, and about Ed Wood, and that he's been looking for a wrestler or an actor. He didn't know which. And every place he's looked, they kept telling, you know, George Steele's the one. So I met up with him in L.A., and he said, "You're too short." So I figured that was the end of the story. About 2 months later, I get a phone call, and he said, "Well, we made you some bigger shoes to make you stand taller, and we want to go with you." And I didn't know who Tori Johnson was.
He said,
"It's going to be easy. You look just like this movie star." So I get up, you know, he sent me the script, then they send me some videos, and I start studying Tori Johnson, and I find out he's the first movie star to do monster movies without makeup. And I look like a movie star. Come on.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a good thing. I mean, the movie won 2 Academies.
Right.
Me and my wife were out there for 4.5 months making the thing. It was a black and white TV. Bill Murray was on the set. Martin Landau. Johnny Depp was the star. Patricia Arquette. It was just a stunning group of people. And it was a black and white movie about Ed Wood, who made 7 of the worst 10 movies ever made.
Exactly.
And so there we are, you know. It worked.
It really did. It was a great film.
Well, it was big. It was received big time in L.A. and New York. I think it kind of died in Peoria. But they're still using that film in schools that, you know, that have film schools.
Yeah.
Because it showed how they used to do it. We took Tim, you know, everything was right on. And he took pictures of people making Ed Wood with the second camera behind them. So there was 2 cameras involved. And they use it now just to show how video was how it was developed.
Yeah.
Which is way over my head.
Plan 9 from Outer Space.
You got it.
Yeah.
I never heard of it.
I don't think you want to hear about it, George. Yeah,
I saw it.
That was a bad one.
Oh, that was one of the worst, I'm telling you.
Well, George, I tell you, it's been a real pleasure having you with us tonight, talking about your legendary wrestling career.
Well, thank you for having me.
I thank you for being with us and sharing part of your Sunday night with us.
Well, we appreciate it.
George the Animal Steel, folks. After the break, we'll talk to former Knicks guard Rod Strickland on Sports Talk 1240. Stick around, folks.
You're listening to AM 1240 WGBB.com, the station that serves your community.